A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking whether Judaism has ever had a movement of monks or anything genuinely monastic. And he's not asking about modern retreat centers or summer camps. He's asking whether there's something structurally parallel to the Christian monastic tradition, with celibacy and communal living and withdrawal from the world. It's a sharper question than it sounds, because the obvious answer is no, not really, but the interesting answer is, well, it depends on what you're willing to count.
That's exactly where this gets fascinating. By the way, quick note, today's episode script is being generated by DeepSeek V4 Pro. Hello to our Silicon colleague.
Doing the work while we take the credit. Very monastic of it, honestly.
The standard line you'll hear is that Judaism never developed a monastic tradition, period. And if you're using a strict definition, lifelong celibacy, permanent withdrawal from society, a formal rule of life under an abbot or prior, then that's basically correct. There's no Jewish equivalent to the Benedictines or the Carthusians. But that standard line misses something important, which is that Judaism has repeatedly produced communities that look an awful lot like monasticism from certain angles. The Essenes are the obvious starting point.
The Essenes are the one most people vaguely remember from Sunday school or a history documentary, usually in the same breath as the Dead Sea Scrolls. But what were they actually? Because the popular image is just desert sect, wrote Scrolls. Maybe John the Baptist hung out with them.
Right, and that's about 20% accurate and 80% Hollywood. The Essenes were a Jewish sect that flourished from roughly the 2nd century before the Common Era, through the 1st century of the Common Era, so we're talking about a 200 to 300 year window. Our main sources are Philo of Alexandria, Josephus, and Pliny the Elder, 3 first century writers who all describe them in terms that sound strikingly monastic. Philo says there were about 4,000 of them, scattered across Judean towns and villages, but with a major concentration near the Dead Sea. Josephus gives the same number. And here's the key detail. Philo explicitly says they lived in communities, shared all property, held meals in common, and practiced celibacy.
Wait, full celibacy? Because that's the part that would make them monastic rather than just a tight-knit religious community. Lots of groups share meals and property.
This is where the sources get interesting and a little contradictory. Philo says the Essenes were entirely celibate. No marriage, no children. They adopted other people's children and raised them in the discipline. Josephus, writing a bit later, says there were actually 2 orders of Essenes. One was celibate and lived in strict community. The other allowed marriage, but only for the purpose of procreation, and with pretty severe restrictions on when and how. So it's possible the movement evolved over time, or that different communities had different standards. But the celibate wing is the one that looks unmistakably monastic.
You've got a Jewish community in the Judean desert, celibate or mostly celibate, sharing all property, eating communal meals, devoted to prayer and study and ritual purity. That sounds like a monastery. What makes it not one?
A few things. First, there's no evidence they had a formal lifelong vow structure the way Christian monasticism later developed. You didn't take vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience in a ceremony and then wear a habit that marked you for life. It seems to have been more fluid. People joined, people left, some communities were stricter than others. Second, and this is crucial, they didn't see themselves as withdrawing from Judaism. They saw themselves as practicing the purest form of it. They were still participating in the temple cult, at least symbolically. They sent offerings to Jerusalem even if they refused to participate in the sacrifices there because they considered the priesthood corrupt. That's different from Christian monasticism, which, from the start, was a distinct vocation within the church, often involving literal withdrawal to the desert.
They were a reform movement that looked like a monastery from the outside, but understood itself as the real Israel, not a separate calling within Israel.
And that pattern repeats in interesting ways. But before we leave the Essenes, there's one more detail worth mentioning. Pliny the Elder, writing around 77 of the Common Era, describes them this way, and I'm paraphrasing. A solitary people, remarkable beyond all others, without women, without money, living among palm trees. He locates them specifically on the western shore of the Dead Sea, above Ein Gedi. That's almost certainly the settlement at Qumran, which is where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. So we have archaeological evidence that lines up with the literary descriptions. Qumran had a communal dining hall, ritual baths by the dozen, a scriptorium where scrolls were copied. It looks like a monastery because in many functional ways it was one.
Qumran gets destroyed around 68 of the Common Era, during the Jewish revolt against Rome, and the Essenes basically vanish from history after that. But they're not the only example, right? There's another group from the same period that gets even less attention.
And these are, if anything, even more explicitly monastic. We know about them almost entirely from Philo, who wrote a whole treatise called On the Contemplative Life. He describes a community of Jewish ascetics living on the shores of Lake Merodis, which is near Alexandria in Egypt. And the parallels to later Christian monasticism are so striking that some early church historians, like Eusebius in the 4th century, actually claimed the Therapeutae were early Christians. They weren't. Philo is writing in the 1st century, and he's clearly describing Jews. But you can see why Eusebius got confused.
What did their actual practice look like?
Philo describes them as living in individual cells, simple structures with just enough space for prayer and study. They spent their days in contemplation, studying scripture and seeking allegorical meanings. They ate only after sunset, and some went for days without food. They met together on the Sabbath for communal teaching, and they held a great festival every 50 days. Philo calls it a sober banquet, with hymns and sacred dancing and an all-night vigil. And here's the detail that really jumps out. The community included both men and women, but they lived separately, and many of the women were elderly virgins who had voluntarily chosen celibacy.
You've got individual cells, fasting, contemplative prayer, a liturgical calendar, and celibate women. That's basically a sketch of what Christian desert monasticism would look like in Egypt 2 or 3 centuries later. Was there a direct influence?
That's one of the great debates in early church history, and I'm going to give you the honest answer. Nobody really knows. The Therapeutae disappear from the historical record right around the time Christian monasticism starts emerging in Egypt. The geographical overlap is suggestive. Lake Merodis is just outside Alexandria, and the first Christian desert monks, the Desert Fathers, emerge in the Egyptian desert maybe 150 miles south. But there's no textual smoking gun, no document that says Anthony the Great read Philo and decided to become a monk. The scholarly consensus is that it's plausible but unproven. What's definitely true is that Jewish ascetic traditions provided a conceptual framework that was available to early Christians.
The Essenes and the Therapeutae are the two big examples from the late Second Temple period, and then both disappear. And for the next, 1,500 years, Judaism doesn't produce anything that looks monastic.
That's the standard narrative, and it's mostly right, but there are some fascinating exceptions. The one that gets the most attention is the Nazirite vow, which goes all the way back to the Torah. Numbers chapter 6 lays out the rules. A Nazirite abstains from wine and all grape products, doesn't cut their hair, and avoids contact with corpses. The vow could be for a fixed period or, in rare cases, for life. Samson is the famous example, and Samuel the prophet may have been one too. But the Nazirite wasn't a monk. The Nazirite lived in society, owned property, usually had a family. The restrictions were about ritual purity, not withdrawal from the world. It's asceticism without monasticism.
Which is actually the broader Jewish pattern, right? Ascetic practices, fasting, temporary celibacy, dietary restrictions exist throughout Jewish history, but they're almost always embedded in normal communal life rather than separated from it.
Yes, and that's a really important distinction. Judaism has a long tradition of ascetic practice, but it tends to be temporary and instrumental. You fast to mourn, to repent, to prepare for a holy day. You don't fast for 40 years in a cave. The rabbinic tradition is actually somewhat suspicious of permanent asceticism. There's a famous passage in the Talmud, in Tractate Tayanit, where a rabbi says that a person who fasts excessively is called a sinner. And in Tractate Nazir, there's a debate about whether the Nazirite is praiseworthy or whether he's actually doing something wrong by denying himself permitted pleasures. The majority opinion leans toward the view that the Nazirite needs to bring a sin offering at the end of the vow. the implication being that there's something slightly off about renouncing what God has allowed.
Which is a pretty sharp contrast with Christianity, where celibacy and renunciation get valorized as the higher path. Paul says it's better to marry than to burn, but it's better still not to marry. You don't find that hierarchy in rabbinic Judaism.
The rabbinic ideal is the scholar with a wife and children, deeply embedded in community life, not the hermit on a pillar. And that's not an accident. It's built into the theology. Judaism is fundamentally oriented around commandments that require social life. You need a community to have a prayer quorum, a minyan. You need a family to fulfill the commandment to be fruitful and multiply. You need a society to have courts and markets and all the institutions that Halakha regulates. Withdrawing from the world isn't holier. It's actually avoiding your obligations.
That's the theological explanation for why Jewish monasticism never really took off. But there's also a historical explanation, which is that, after the destruction of the Second Temple in 70 of the Common Era, Judaism spent the next 2,000 years as a minority religion, often under hostile rule. Monasteries require a certain degree of security and institutional stability. You can't build a secluded contemplative community when you might be expelled from the country next year.
And it connects to something I want to bring in from the research. There's a fascinating piece from My Jewish Learning that makes exactly this argument, that the conditions for monasticism simply didn't exist for most of Jewish history. When you're a small, often persecuted minority, the religious imperative is survival and continuity, not withdrawal into contemplation. The community can't afford to have its most pious members opt out of family life.
Right. Every celibate Jew is a Jewish family line that ends. In a community of a few thousand people in some medieval town, that's not a spiritual luxury you can afford.
Yet, and yet, there are these pockets, these moments where something monastic-like does emerge. The Hasidei Ashkenaz, the German Pietists of the 12th and 13th centuries, developed a pretty intense ascetic tradition. They practice forms of self-mortification, sitting in ice water in winter, rolling in snow, fasting for days. They had a doctrine of complete indifference to praise and insult, and they cultivated a kind of radical humility that sounds almost like some strains of Christian mysticism. But they were still married, still living in towns, still part of regular Jewish life. It was asceticism within the world, not apart from it.
What about the Kabbalists in 16th century Safed? I remember reading something about them having communal structures that were almost monastic.
This is a great example. Safed in the 16th century was this extraordinary moment. You had figures like Isaac Luria, Moses Cordovero, Joseph Caro, all concentrated in one Galilean hill town. And some of the Lurianic circles did develop practices that look quasi-monastic. They would withdraw to the countryside to greet the Sabbath, spending Friday afternoon in the fields singing hymns. They practiced all-night study vigils. There were small fellowships called Havurot that had strict membership requirements and shared meals and intense devotional practices. But again, they were married, they had children, they were integrated into the economic life of Safed. The Havura was a society within society, not a withdrawal from it.
We keep bumping into the same pattern. Intense community, ascetic practice, shared life, but no celibacy, no permanent withdrawal. It's like Judaism keeps generating 80% of a monastery and then stopping.
That's a perfect way to put it. And it raises the question, is there something about the structure of Judaism itself that prevents that last 20%? I think there is, and it goes back to something we touched on earlier. Christian monasticism is built on a distinction between the counsels of perfection, poverty, chastity, obedience, and the ordinary commandments that apply to everyone. The monk is pursuing a higher calling. Judaism doesn't really have that two-tier structure. There are commandments for everyone, and the goal is to fulfill them as completely as possible within the conditions of ordinary life. The scholar who studies Torah while holding down a job and raising children is not on a lower track than someone who withdraws to the desert. If anything, he's on the higher one.
Which is why the Nazirite has to bring a sin offering. You're not supposed to opt out.
And that's the deep theological reason why Jewish monasticism never became a stable institution. But I want to complicate this a little because there is one modern example that blurs the line, and it's not well known outside certain circles.
I was hoping you'd get to this. You're talking about the modern attempts, right? The kibbutz movement, or something more explicitly religious.
The kibbutz is an interesting comparison, but it's not what I'm thinking of. The early kibbutzim were communal, they shared property, they ate together, they were often intensely ideological, but they were secular, they were about building a new society, not withdrawing from it. They were the opposite of monastic. What I'm thinking of is a specific phenomenon that emerged in the 20th century among some ultra-Orthodox communities. The kollel system pushed to an extreme, where married men study full-time and the community supports them. But even that is family-based. No, the closest thing to a genuine monastic experiment in modern Judaism is probably the attempt by a few individuals and small groups to create actual Jewish monastic communities with celibacy.
I didn't know anyone had tried that. When and where?
There have been a few isolated attempts, mostly in the 20th century, mostly short-lived. The most documented one is probably the community founded by a man named Yosef Yozel Horowitz, known as the Altar of Novardok, in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. He established a network of yeshivas that practiced an extreme form of musar, ethical self-discipline, where students would deliberately humiliate themselves, going into bakeries and asking for nails, things like that, to cultivate indifference to social opinion. The communities were intense, all-consuming, with students living together in near-total dedication to study and self-perfection. But they still married eventually. They weren't celibate.
Still 80%.
There were a few genuine experiments with celibate Jewish communities in the 20th century, mostly in the United States, mostly associated with the Jewish Renewal Movement or with individuals who were influenced by Eastern spirituality. But none of them lasted more than a generation, and none gained any significant following. The institutional and theological barriers were just too strong.
Let me push on something. You said the theological barrier is that Judaism doesn't have a two-tier system of ordinary versus higher callings. But doesn't it, in practice? The Kohen, the priestly class, had special restrictions. They couldn't marry a divorcee. They had purity rules that didn't apply to ordinary Israelites. The Nazirite had special restrictions. The rabbi, in a traditional community, has a special status. It's not higher in the Christian sense, but it's distinct.
That's a fair push, and I think the distinction is this. In Christianity, the monastic calling is ontologically higher. It's closer to God, more perfect, more meritorious. In Judaism, the distinct roles are functional, not hierarchical in the same way. The Kohen has a job to do, and the restrictions are job requirements, not spiritual attainments. The rabbi is a teacher and a judge, not a spiritual virtuoso. The greatest sage and the simplest laborer are obligated in the same commandments and judged by the same standard. There's no path of supererogation, no treasury of merits you can build up beyond what's required.
Which actually makes the Essenes and Therapeutae even more anomalous, doesn't it? They were doing something that the mainstream tradition would eventually reject, but they were doing it before the rabbinic tradition fully crystallized. They represent a path not taken.
The Second Temple period was incredibly diverse. You had Sadducees, Pharisees, Essenes, Therapeutae, various apocalyptic groups, probably others we don't even know about. After the destruction of the temple, the Pharisaic tradition won out and became what we now call Rabbinic Judaism. The other strands either died out or became Christianity. So in a sense, the Essenes and Therapeutae are fossils of a Jewish landscape that no longer exists, a landscape where monastic-style communities were one option among many.
There's something almost poignant about that. A whole form of Jewish life that flourished for centuries and then just... And now when people think of monks, they think of Christianity or Buddhism, never Judaism.
Yet the echoes are still there in the texts. The Dead Sea Scrolls include a document called the Community Rule, which lays out the regulations for the Qumran community. It describes a process of initiation that took several years, with stages of increasing integration. Candidates were examined on their understanding and their conduct. They surrendered their property to the community. They ate at the common table only after being fully admitted. This is not just a study group or a prayer circle. This is a formal, structured, disciplined communal life that looks, in its outlines, remarkably like a monastic rule.
What does the community rule actually say about the purpose of all this? Why did they think they needed to live this way?
The core idea is purity and preparation. The community saw itself as the true Israel, the remnant that had kept the covenant while the rest of the nation had gone astray. They believed they were living in the final age, that God was about to intervene decisively in history, and that their communal life was a kind of anticipatory holiness. They were living now as they would live in the Messianic age. There is a beautiful phrase in the community rule about the community being a house of holiness for Israel, an assembly of supreme holiness for Aaron. They saw themselves as a living temple, substituting for the corrupted temple in Jerusalem.
It's eschatological. They're not withdrawing from the world because the world is inherently bad. They're withdrawing to create a pocket of the future in the present. That's actually quite different from some strands of Christian monasticism that see the world as a place of temptation to be fled.
That's a really important distinction. The Essene withdrawal was strategic and temporary in their own understanding. They were waiting for the end, and when it came, they would be vindicated and the temple would be purified and everything would be set right. They weren't trying to escape embodiment or creation. They were trying to embody the covenant more perfectly in a time of corruption. And that's actually very Jewish, even if the form it took. Celibacy, communal property, desert isolation looks un-Jewish from a later rabbinic perspective.
Let me ask you about the therapeutai specifically, because they're even more intriguing to me. Philo describes them as contemplatives. Their whole life is prayer and study, an allegorical interpretation of scripture. No manual labor, no economic production, just... That's closer to the Buddhist model than anything else in the Jewish tradition. How did they support themselves?
Philo says they had given away their property before joining the community. They lived simply. Remember, individual cells, minimal food, no luxuries. It's not entirely clear how the economics worked, but given that they were near Alexandria, a major Jewish population center, it's likely they were supported by donations from the wider Jewish community. Philo mentions that they had disciples and admirers. And here's another detail. Philo says they were devoted to the contemplation of nature as well as scripture. They saw the natural world as a kind of text to be read allegorically. That's practically Franciscan, 400 years before Francis.
They had this 50-day festival with dancing and hymns. What was that about?
Philo describes it in extraordinary detail. It was a vigil held every seventh Sabbath, so every 49 days, with the festival on the 50th. They would gather in white robes, men and women together but seated separately. They would sing hymns, sometimes in chorus, sometimes antiphonally, back and forth. They would share a simple meal of bread and water with a little hyssop. And then they would stay up all night singing and dancing, men and women, in separate choirs, until at dawn they would turn east, raise their hands, and pray for the coming of divine light. Philo explicitly compares it to the Israelites crossing the Red Sea and singing the Song of the Sea, with Moses leading the men and Miriam leading the women.
That's gorgeous, and also completely alien to anything in later rabbinic Judaism. A sober banquet with all-night sacred dancing? The rabbis would have had a collective heart attack.
Yet Philo presents it as entirely Jewish, entirely continuous with the tradition. He calls them philosophers. He calls their practice the highest form of wisdom. And he's writing for a Greek-speaking audience, but he's clearly proud of them as examples of Jewish piety. It's a reminder of how much diversity was lost when the Second Temple fell.
Here's the question I keep coming back to. If the Essenes and Therapeutai were genuine Jewish monastic movements, and the evidence sure seems to point that way, why didn't they leave any lasting imprint on Judaism? Christianity took the monastic impulse and ran with it for 2,000 years. Judaism buried it.
I think there are three reasons, and they reinforce each other. First, the historical catastrophe, the Jewish revolts against Rome, the destruction of the temple, the depopulation of Judea. The Essenes were concentrated in Judea, and they were annihilated or scattered. The Therapeutai were in Egypt, and the Jewish community in Alexandria was decimated in a revolt a few decades later. The institutional continuity was simply broken.
The rabbinic tradition that survived was the one least interested in monasticism.
Right, that's the second reason. The Pharisees, who became the rabbis, had always been skeptical of the Essenes. They disagreed on matters of law, on the calendar, on the temple cult. When the Pharisees were the only ones left standing, their perspective became normative, and their perspective was fundamentally oriented toward community life, family, and the study house, not the desert commune.
The third reason?
Once Christianity emerged as a separate religion and began developing its own monastic tradition, monasticism became associated with Christianity. For Jews living in Christian lands, the monk was the other, sometimes the persecutor. The very idea of a Jewish monk would have seemed like a contradiction in terms, or worse, a form of apostasy. So the theological resistance to monasticism was reinforced by a social and political resistance. You didn't want to look like the people who were trying to convert you.
That's a really sharp point. The boundary between Judaism and Christianity hardened over the centuries, and anything that looked too Christian became suspect. Celibacy, withdrawal, contemplative orders, that was their thing, not ours.
You can see this dynamic playing out even today. When Jews visit Christian monasteries, there's often a sense of fascination mixed with a kind of wariness. This is beautiful. This is spiritually intense. This is not for us. The boundary is internalized.
Here's a counterpoint. In the last 50 years, there's been a growing interest among some Jews in contemplative practice, in meditation, in retreat. Jewish meditation centers have popped up. There are Jewish silent retreats now. Is that a recovery of something like the Therapeutai, or is it just Buddhism with a Jewish coat of paint?
It's a little of both, honestly. There's definitely an influence from Eastern spirituality. A lot of the early Jewish meditation teachers spent time in Buddhist contexts and brought those techniques back. But there's also a genuine recovery of Jewish contemplative sources that had been neglected. The Kabbalistic tradition has extensive meditation practices. Hasidism has practices of Hit Bodhidut, solitary prayer in nature, that Rabbi Nachman of Breslov especially emphasized. These are authentic Jewish traditions that fell into disuse and are now being revived.
Still no celibacy, still no permanent withdrawal. The meditation retreat lasts a week, and then you go home to your family.
The structure is still temporary, still embedded in ordinary life. Nobody's founding a Jewish monastery in the Judean desert. Although, and this is where it gets interesting, there are a few places that come close. There's a community in the Galilee called Kibbutz Lotan that combines ecological living with Jewish practice in a way that has some monastic resonances. There are a few urban intentional communities in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv where people live together, pray together, and share a common spiritual discipline. But none of them are celibate. None of them are permanent vocations in the monastic sense. They're experiments in communal living, not monasteries.
The scorecard is Essenes, yes, monastic, extinct for 2,000 years. Therapeutai, yes, even more monastic, extinct even longer. Nazarites, ascetic but not monastic. Hasidei Ashkenaz, intense but not withdrawn. Safed Havurot, close but no celibacy. Modern experiments, interesting but marginal. Is that fair?
That's the honest summary. Judaism has repeatedly generated communities that look monastic from certain angles, but it has never institutionalized monasticism as a permanent vocation within the religion. The theological, historical, and sociological barriers have always been too strong, and yet the impulse keeps surfacing. The desire for intense communal holiness, for withdrawal from the corruption of the world, for a life devoted entirely to prayer and study, that's clearly present in the Jewish soul. It just expresses itself differently.
Which brings us back to Daniel's question. Has Judaism ever had a movement of monks? The answer is yes, twice, a long time ago, and then never again. But the deeper answer is that the question assumes a Christian framework, monk as a distinct category of religious life, and Judaism doesn't really work that way. The holiness isn't in the withdrawal, it's in the engagement.
Yet I'll admit, every time I read Philo on the Therapeutai, I feel a little pang of something, or curiosity about what might have been. There's a whole alternate history of Judaism where the contemplative life was a live option, where you could choose between the study house and the desert cell. We don't live in that history. But knowing it existed, even briefly, changes how I think about what Judaism can contain.
That's a lovely note, and I think it's where we should leave it. The Essenes and Therapeutai remind us that the Jewish past is stranger and more various than we usually remember. And the fact that their path closed off doesn't mean it wasn't Jewish while it lasted.
And now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
The oldest known Islamic world map, the Mappa Mundi from the Book of Curiosities, produced in 11th century Fatimid Egypt, measures just 33 by 21 centimeters, yet contains over 400 place names stretching from the Seychelles to Scandinavia.
400 place names on something the size of a dinner napkin. That's impressive cartography.
From the Seychelles, no less.
The one forward-looking thought I want to leave listeners with is this. We're in a moment right now where the boundaries of Jewish practice are more fluid than they've been in centuries. New communities are forming, old traditions are being recovered, and the question of what Jewish life can look like is open. Whether that openness produces anything that looks monastic? Probably not, for all the reasons we've discussed. But if it did, it wouldn't be unprecedented. The therapeutai would recognize it.
On that note, our thanks to producer Hilbert Flumingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back soon.
Take care, everyone.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.